I'd like to give a little talk this evening on the forest tradition, what the forest tradition is, what it means, because we use this word quite a lot, and of all the words that are used to describe schools of Buddhism, then it's the one which to me is the most relevant. As soon as we start talking about Mahayana and Theravada, or talking about Thai tradition or Burmese tradition or Ajahn Chah tradition or something like that. These are concepts which are, to me, really irrelevant to spiritual practice. They have a certain function in the conventional sense, but they don't really mean anything in terms of how we approach developing the Eightfold Path. Whereas the forest tradition, the name of the forest tradition is something which, to me, is very meaningful. And if you notice in the description of the gradual training, where it talks about the monastic lifestyle and how we're supposed to practice leading up to liberation, then at that critical juncture where the text turns from a consideration of what we might call practicing daily life, although I have to put as a footnote here that I detest the term daily life, and I have an open invitation for anybody to suggest a better alternative. But anyway, daily life practice, when we're eating, when we're sleeping, when we're talking, and so on. And then the text turns to specifically to meditation. And at that juncture, when it turns to meditation, it says, Ida bhikkhave bhikkhu aranyagato wa rukamulagato wa sunyagaragato. Okay, one has gone to the forest, gone to the root of a tree, or gone to an empty hut. And that's where you sit down and cross-legged, close the eyes, go into meditation. And so the forest is not something which is arbitrary or sort of peripheral to Buddhist practice. It's right there at the heart. And so that teaching on the gradual training, it doesn't say anything about samatha versus vipassana. It doesn't say anything about Burmese meditation techniques or the Thai Kruba Ajahn tradition. It doesn't say anything about Mahayana and Theravada or Abhidhamma or anything like that. But it does say, go on to the forest. And so we know that this is something which, again, that the Buddha himself did. And the Buddha himself wasn't Mahayanist or Theravadan. If you asked him that, are you Mahayanist or Theravadan? He'd say, what are you talking about? I don't understand those words. I've never heard them before. They're meaningless to me. So the Buddha was a forest monk. He loved to go and live in the forest. He loved to stay in that peaceful place and to do his meditation. And so that's, to me, is a real tradition, a real genuine part of the Buddhist tradition and heritage, not something that's just made up by later monks based on some ideological or political dispute. And it's not only authentic in that sense, it's authentic in the sense of being a very real and very genuine part of our experience. We wake up in the morning and there it is. Look out the window and there's the forest. You're breathing it in. Whenever we breathe, we're breathing in the oxygen which the trees around us are breathing out. We can smell the gum trees, the smell of the flowers, the kind of the indefinable odour of an Australian bush landscape. We can hear the sound that the forest makes, the sound of the wind through the leaves, extraordinary exotic sounds of the lyrebirds and other animals in the forest. We touch the forest when we're walking. We touch the ground. We can feel the roughness of it under our feet. We can touch the trees, touch the rocks. So we directly engage with the forest with our senses. We don't usually taste the forest, although we theoretically could do it. But all our senses are engaged in it. It actually constitutes our environment, what it is that's around us, what it is that we're a part of. and just in the these days we're installing a new rainwater system. And so once that's in place, then we'll be drinking the environment as well. So then we will actually be tasting it, because that'll be in the water that we drink. So it becomes a part of us. So living in the forest is a very embedded experience, very embodied experience. And staying in the forest is one of the most important ways that we can ensure that our Dhamma practice stays real and stays grounded. And we all know that it's very easy in Buddhism to drift off, to become concerned with philosophical discussions or abstract discussions or meditation states, or thinking about the texts and the meaning and so on and so forth. So all of those things are part of our practice. They're part of, say, right thought in the Eightfold Path, or right speech in the Eightfold Path. There's nothing wrong with them. But if they're taken to an extreme, they tend to lead towards a disembodied approach to Dhamma, which we sometimes recognize as an academic approach to Dhamma. So when in academic life, when you sit at a desk, the top half of your body is chopped off from the bottom half of your body. So what's above the desk essentially is your head and your arms for doing things. So your head for thinking and talking, and the arms for doing, and hands for doing. The rest of your body is separated and sort of slumps and does what it wants underneath the desk, and it's not a matter of your concern. It's almost like two separate beings. That's what a desk does to you. I should know, I sit behind one all too much. So this is one reason why whenever I go to Dhamma centers, if I go and I teach in various places, I have this habit in some places, and I especially noticed it when I was in Malaysia and Singapore, that they'll sit you at a Dhamma seat and they'll put a table in front of you with maybe a cloth over the table or something, so that people in front of you can only see your head and maybe your arms. And so this is so unlike the right way this should be done in Buddhism. In Buddhism, if you look at how the Buddha teaches, you see the whole Buddha, not just his head. It's not just talking head. So the first thing I do in those places is get them to take the table away from in front of me. And the second thing I do is get them to turn the fluorescent lights off. This is another good way of destroying Dhamma talk. So when we're staying in the forest, we find that our senses become attuned to the forest in quite subtle ways without us thinking about it too much or paying too much attention to it. When I first went to Thailand, as Ajahn Chah described the Western monks, he said that they have stupid feet. And it's a very, very apt description, of course, because when you're used to walking on smooth surfaces and you're used to wearing shoes all the time, then you don't get a sensitivity and a mindfulness in where you put your feet. And so you're always tripping over things and stubbing your toes and so on. And of course I did that as much or more than anybody else, and broke a couple of toes and so on, stubbing them on rocks and tree roots and things. But spent a while walking without shoes and staying in some quite rough places and walking without shoes. And after a while that stopped happening. I stopped stubbing my feet and getting cuts and things like that. So you get this kind of, it's a natural training. Another example that happened to me once was when I was walking through the forest at Wananachat. And I was just walking along minding my own business, and it was a quiet afternoon, and I heard a sound just off to the side of the path. And it was just a very, very soft sound, something moving. And as soon as I heard that sound, I immediately knew that I didn't know what that was. I immediately knew that it wasn't an animal or anything that I was familiar with. It wasn't a snake. It wasn't a squirrel. It wasn't the ants moving in the leaves. It wasn't a lizard. It wasn't anything which we normally see around there and which you'd expect to find. It wasn't a bird. So just listening very closely, very soft, slow, deliberate sound of something moving through the bush, And I looked, I couldn't see anything, so I sort of walked carefully off the path and sort of looking around to see whether I could find it. What was it? And then I saw in front of me was a huge tarantula creeping through the forest floor. I never saw one before or since at Manachar. And it was just walking very, very deliberately and making this kind of slow movement on the leaves. So quite an astonishing thing to see. And I noticed this tarantula was heading directly for a kuti nearby. So I went round to the kuti and told the owner of the kuti, watch out, there's a tarantula headed for you. So but that was very interesting for me because it showed me, I had never thought of that before. I never thought that I'd learnt to identify the sounds of the forest. But clearly I had. You know, it's like a subconscious training. So it showed me how I'd become aware of my environment just through living there and through practicing mindfulness. So these are some of the ways that living in the forest is useful as part of our practice. And of course, in the Buddha's time, most of the land was forest. There was relatively few settled areas, only a small number of moderately sized cities, you know, and what are kind of very grandly called, you know, the royal capitals of Rajagaha and Savatthi and so on, probably were, you know, maybe the size of Goulburn or something like that. They certainly wouldn't have been, you know, big cities by our standards. And then lots of little villages and tracks through the jungle. So wandering from place to place and staying in the forest was a very much more normal part of the lifestyle. Much of the land, of course, was unclaimed. So unlike today, where every square inch is either belongs to private owner or belongs to the state, in those days, much of the land was simply unclaimed, and you could just go and stay there. Now, one of the things about the forest is that the forest is very ambivalent. And it's actually quite terrifying. And we find in the suttas these two aspects of the forest. On the one hand, the forest is very beautiful, and there are many verses, for example, the very lovely lyrical verses of Mahakasapa, where he praises the beauty of the forests and the animals in there and the flowers and the clear water and the rocks and so on. And says how happy it makes him to be staying and practicing in that environment. And yet at the same time, there's also this sense of danger in the forest. A very real danger, you know, it's not just an imaginary thing. There are snakes, lots of them. There's tigers, there's elephants, there's bears, all kinds of wild and dangerous animals living in the forests. Even lions in those days still, you know, part of India. Crocodiles, all kinds of things. So people in those days didn't have such a romantic idea of the forest as we do. And that's really just a sort of a modern, middle-class, urban thing that we've in a sense had the luxury in the last 100 years or so of being able to really romanticize the forest. Mainly because we don't have to live there. And because when we are there, we know that we have the technology and so on to protect ourselves. For the forest, the wilderness has very largely lost its fear for us. Yes, it's still there to some degree, but very largely it's lost. And so we, for the most part, see, certainly from an Australian point of view, I know this is culturally quite different and seen in different ways, in different places. Certainly in Australia, we normally see the forest as being somewhere that's very benign, where you have to be careful, but which is essentially a benign place. And so there's this ambiguity. On the one hand, a the sense of the beauty and like auspiciousness of the forest, but also the sense of the fear. And the forest is so in mythology, the forest of the wilderness is always the classical location where one has to go to in order to find one's path. So to And I think this is really critical to understanding how the forest works for us in Buddhism. In any spiritual tradition, we always have a tendency to lock things down, to close them up. We have the tendency to crystallize doctrine into a set of formulas, to turn a path of practice which originally was sort of a magical sense of self-discovery, and instead we turn that into a set of formulas and practices to be mastered. And that tendency always happens, especially when you have large institutions, which especially are urban-based and so on, and you have to sort of keep control of large numbers of people. So you have, you know, say large monasteries, 300, 400 monks, in some places in Tibet, even bigger, in China, even bigger monasteries. And all these, and you all have to sort of somehow control them and get them working together. And in mythology, it's always when you leave that urban controlled environment that you really encounter the truth. And of course, that's exactly what happened in the Buddha's biography, the life story of the Buddha, that while he was staying in the home, in a sense, he's always been conditioned and acculturated to this, to the conventions of his society, the conventions of his culture, the conventions of his upbringing. And if he wants to find something that's outside of that, something that's deeper, something that's truer, he has to leave all that behind, go into the forest. The forest is formless in that sense. So the forest is not imposing conventions and societal norms and so on us, but the forest is calling us to engage in the reality of what's happening in the present moment. So the forest is always that place, or the wilderness is always that place where conventions break down, where the strictures and restraints of society no longer apply. Right? And of course that's very threatening, it's very dangerous, psychically as well as the physical danger I was referring to before, but it's psychically very dangerous as well. And the Buddha actually cautioned against it. And he said that basically unless someone has their mind is reasonably mature and their meditation is good, then they shouldn't be spending time alone in the forest. So it's not that, by making this distinction and this dichotomy, I'm not saying that the forest is all good and that the city or urban environment is all bad. I'm not trying to say that at all. I'm trying to say that they have quite distinctive and necessary functions, each of which is really essential for our spiritual path. And I think this is something which we need to be very careful of in Buddhism, and which I personally am very, very suspicious of, is anyone who claims to be able to really capture the truth of meditative or spiritual or personal development through some kind of formula or very kind of highly structured path of practice and so on. I don't believe in those things. I think the Buddha gave some general guidelines in practice, which we can take and apply, but the specifics and the details of those things, I think, are very personal and will emerge very differently in different people. And they need to, they must do. As long as you are practicing a method, you're still stuck in that conventional world. And so when we come to the forest, we leave all that behind. And so when each of us, when we go back to our kutis, we go back to our huts, we leave behind our personalities. We leave behind our station in life. I'm not an abbot when I go back to my hut. You're not an anagarika or a bhikkhuni or whatever. It's just this. It's just, what is this experience I'm having now? I can hear, I can see. And here is this inside that, in relation to that, existing now in relation to this environment. And so according to how the spiritual path develops, and according to the mythology of the wilderness, it's that place in the wilderness that from there that our dreams, our monsters, our fears, and also our greatest desires, our fantasies and aspirations, can all come to us. And this is depicted in the myth of the life of the Buddha, which we'll be looking at some more tomorrow, when it talks about armies of Mara attacking the Buddha, and so on. So these kind of very kind of graphic and fanciful descriptions, which of course are just an attempt to render vivid in a narrative form those experiences that happen in the forest. And even though when we read them as literature, they seem to us really over the top, very unrealistic, like fantasy. But actually, in terms of our actual experience in the forest, what happens is that when we're staying there by ourselves in the forest, everything gets amplified. Because we're not having that input from outside that's dictating to us what we should think, how we should behave, what we should do, then our inner sense of perception and imagination and creativity and all these things starts to open up, and everything becomes more vivid. Our mind becomes much more sensitive. As awareness and mindfulness is growing, everything becomes clearer, both good and bad. The sounds outside become more clear. We can hear the sounds, the distant sounds of the birds, and even a gentle rustle of the leaves. We can feel inside ourselves just a momentary thought or a subtle shift in our emotion. And then from that experience in the forest, where there's an understanding of oneself, an understanding of the truth in some way that's deeper. Everything is demolished. Everything has gone back to its natural state. We're left with a kind of a blank state. And from that, the new truth arises. The illumination happens because we're not being dictated to by our preconceptions of what the truth is. We're allowing the truth to arise within us. And so bringing that back out, we come to apply that in the world of conventions again. And so the Buddha decides he wants to go and teach and so on, and sets up a Sangha and all of these kinds of things. So this is the same process that we see happening again and again through the Buddhist traditions. And if you look in any of the Buddhist traditions, you'll see the same thing. For example, the great yogi Milarepa in Tibet, who sort of went off into the mountains and the caves and warned people against going down to where the big monasteries were and so on, because there's too much worldly activity there. Or else in China and Japan, of course, the great Zen masters and Bodhidharma and others who would disappear into caves or into the wilderness and practice. Sometimes they just stay there. Other times they practice for a period of time and then come back. So you always find this countercurrent in the Buddhist tradition which rebels against and reacts against the tendency of Buddhism to mainstream itself, to become an institution, to become set in terms of formulas, procedures, rules and regulations and so on. And, you know, I have no doubts where my sympathy lies, even though I have a kind of a formal recognition of the fact that it's necessary for religion to become institutionalized and so on in some senses. And I understand that, and I also participate in it. I also have to do that as someone who's an abbot. I have a managerial role and a formal role. But actually that's not where my love is. That's not where my inspiration comes from. My inspiration comes from that thought of rebellion, of letting go of the conventions, of just disappearing into the forest, and then finding what we don't know, we can't say, we can't formulate, that truth that has no name, that can't be spoken. And just as this pattern has been recurring, and we've seen it in some of the early Mahayana sutras, where they follow the same thing, rejecting the institutionalized Abhidhamma Buddhism of the great monasteries in favor of the contemplative life in the forest, the same thing down through the traditions. And in the modern time, of course, in the most famous forest tradition in Thailand, with the established by Ajahn Mun. And like in most or perhaps all of these traditions, Ajahn Mun and the first generation of the forest monks all started life as city monks. So they didn't ordain into the forest tradition. They ordained as city monks. and they did some certain degree of study and practice in that context, learning the Dhamma and so on before going into the forest. Now, at that time, the connotation of a forest monk was very different from the connotation it has today. And a forest monk, before Ajahn Mun's time, forest monks were mainly felt to be, they were more like sort of shamanistic or black magic figures. They would do different kinds of magics for various kinds of things. It might be curses, fertility magic, foretelling the future, all of these kinds of things. And so there was felt to be a bit of a special sort of charisma to that kind of thing. And Thai Buddhism, like other forms of Buddhism around the world, has great belief in all of these kinds of magic mandalas and formulas and all of these kinds of things, which you find as a kind of the detritus of real religion everywhere. And there was a very interesting article in the Guardian newspaper this morning about exactly that in India. And there was a black tantric shaman magician who claimed to be able to kill people with a word on a TV program. And so there was a skeptic on the program, so the skeptic said, okay, well, kill me with a word then. And he challenged him to do it, and he tried again and again and again, repeatedly, all of these mantras and spells. And then he said, okay, well, we'll come back for another rematch. And so he got everything organized and whole teams of chanters and black magic and everything he could do to try to kill this person. And the person just laughed. And that was the end of that. And apparently it was one of the most popular media events in India in the last few days. It's really taken the country by storm, proving how vacuous some of these claims are, which people take so seriously. So this was the kind of thing which was often practiced in the forest. And you can see what's going on here is that these kind of practitioners are going into that world of the formless, the unconscious, the wild, the magical, without having the discipline, without having the intellectual rigor, without having the theoretical understanding of the Dhamma. And so this is why they go off the rails, and this is why that kind of practice is not what the Buddha said. And this is a very real thing, and very it's not just a theory, it's a very real experience. If you go and you find monks, and I say monks because I don't know any examples of nuns in this context, but if you find monks who have done that, who have just gone and lived in the forest without having teaching and training and so on beforehand, almost always they are just out there. They're not really spiritually developed. They're just a bit cranky and eccentric and haven't really got it together. Of course, there may well be exceptions to that, but generally speaking, this is what I've experienced. And as I said, generally speaking, with most or just about all of the great monks in the forest tradition, Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Mahabua, Ajahn Lee, Ajahn Tate, that they all spent time in city monasteries and study monasteries learning to some degree the teachings. And so if you look at how they teach Dhamma, they have a familiarity with the Buddhist technical terms, the descriptions of the Eightfold Path and so on and so forth. So they're not unlettered or untutored in that sense. So with tradition, when Ajahn Mun and so on wanted to go back into the forest, of course this was dependent on the revolution in Thai Buddhism that had been initiated by Prince Mongkut when he was a monk. And of course the story goes that when Mongkut ordained as a bhikkhu, he went study in a meditation monastery for his first rains retreat and to practice meditation, and he was extremely dissatisfied because nobody could answer his questions. And he'd say, why are we supposed to practice this way? And they'd say, we don't know, we're just telling you what our teachers told us. And they couldn't explain or given any understanding of what they were doing. And Mongkut was very critical of this, and he called it the Achin Nakapika Wada, the the teaching or the school which just teaches what's customary and passed down by tradition. And he said that we should reject that, and instead we need to find out what it is that the Buddha actually taught and try to practice that. And so for the rest of his life as a bhikkhu, he mainly was involved in the study of Pali and trying to figure out what the teachings were based on the text critical study of the early teaching. So as far as I know, he never went back to do intensive meditation practice, although he probably kept up some meditation practice. So that textual study laid the groundwork, which was later taken by Ajahn Mun and so on. Of course, you know, these days you find this very kind of dismissal of academic and textual work and say, well, it's not experience. But of course, the thing is that if you're reading the suttas and if you're taking them seriously, the suttas are always telling you, go off and meditate, go off and meditate, go off and meditate. So you can't really take the suttas seriously without being moved in that direction of contemplation. So I really don't see this dichotomy that a lot of people talk about here. And so this is what the generation of Ajahn Mun and others around that time were doing, is they were trying to reinvigorate, re-establish the forest tradition, which had effectively been lost. And they weren't, as far as I understand, they weren't following along a kind of, a pre-existing tradition. I mean, obviously there was some tradition there, but the story of Ajahn Mun insists that at a certain stage in his development, he had to surpass what any of his teachers told him and rediscover the truth for himself. So the story of the founding of the modern forest tradition is very much a rediscovery of things, rather than a continuation of a forest tradition. I'm not trying to deny that there's any continuity. There is some continuity, but there's also quite a marked shift at that point. And of course, in Ajahn Mun's practice, the critical things were the practices of the strict practice of Vinaya, living in the forest, a strict practice of the Dutanga ascetic practices, and a lot of emphasis on meditation over scriptural study, and in particular in meditation, body contemplation, as well as recollection of the Buddha through Buddho meditation and breath meditation, but also a lot of contemplation of the parts of the body, the elements, and so on. And so really based largely on the first section of the Saripatthana Sutta. It seems to have been the most influential, or perhaps the Kayagadasati Sutta is more relevant for the forest tradition. So and this has really established the main meditative practices that have come to define the forest tradition from then on. Of course, Ajahn Mun had a number of very talented disciples, many of whom were just good monks who just remain relatively unknown, but an astonishingly large number of them went on to become great teachers themselves, as well as the ones who were familiar with from their English translations, like Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Mahabhur, Ajahn Tate, Ajahn Lee, is actually only a fairly small number, and a lot of others like Ajahn Chop, Ajahn Phran, Ajahn Sao, and Ajahn Bunni, Ajahn Bua, and others, and Budu, many others have not become known in English or internationally, basically because they never had any Western monks as their students, and so they didn't have their works translated and their talks translated and published in English as these other teachers did. So this has established a very successful and very prominent movement in Thai Buddhism of the forest tradition. And of course the forest tradition has its own history and its own development. And the forest tradition very much romanticizes the era and the practices of Ajahn Mahabhur, Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Chah and so on, constantly telling stories about this is what Ajahn Mun did in his days as a monk, this is what Ajahn Chah did, and so on and so forth. And so it's very much based on anecdotes of the practices and the teachings of the great Ajahns within that tradition to a quite extraordinary degree. And if you're staying in those monasteries, you know, you'll find that there's almost no understanding of any other traditions of Buddhism. There's even very little talk of anything in Theravada outside of the forest tradition. It's a very insular tradition. It's a constantly self-referential tradition. Very little discussion of, say, the suttas and things like that, but always talking and pointing back to the practice of Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Mahabua, and the other great teachers. That's the nature of that tradition. And of course, over time, what tended to happen is this, that the forest tradition started out with some monks who really wanted to practice. They would leave the big monasteries. They would go into the forest, wander from place to place through the wilderness, stay in the poorest villages, or just in a little under a mosquito net. Eventually, they would be invited to stay in one place for the rains retreat. The villagers would build some simple huts for them, and they would stay there. If they wanted to stay on after the rains retreat, gradually the huts would become more permanent, the monastery would become more defined. As the village expands, then there would be a need to define the land boundaries, put up fences, put up walls. As the number of monks grows, then there's a need for a sala, meeting hall. There's a need for a shed for dyeing and washing robes and so on. There's a need for, eventually there's too many monks to be able to rely on just the alms from the local alms round, so they'll need to be built a kitchen and so on. And originally there might be just a bookshelf in the back of the monastery, but that becomes inadequate, so you have to build a library. They have to build an upasita hall and for holding the sanghakamas and so on, and then the sala where the meals and so on are held in becomes too busy with too many things, so you have to build another meditation sala at the back of the monastery and so on. And then you've got another big monastery, which is exactly what they ran away from in the first place. Yeah. And so that's the cycle and the life cycle of the monastery. And the death point of a monastery is marked by the building of a stupa. When the main teacher in a monastery dies, usually what happens is that their relics, their ashes and so on, will be interred in a stupa, which may be of varying degrees of magnificence. For just an ordinary monk or teacher, it'll be very simple. In some cases, of course, it's an extremely grand edifice. In the case of Ajahn Chah, of course, it's a magnificent structure. And others have also some great structures. Of course, this building of a stupa being in many ways completely the antithesis of the forest tradition ethos. And I remember one of Ajahn Mahabua's Dhamma talks where he says, when I die, I don't want anybody coming and doing big ceremonies. Don't get all these monks come along chanting Kusala Dhamma, Akusala Dhamma. I've gone way beyond Kusala and Akusala, good and evil. I've left them behind years ago. My mind's got nothing to do with good and evil. There's no point in coming and chanting for me. Just throw me out the back of the monastery and let the maggots come and feed on my body. I don't care. That's Ajahn Mahabua's very outspoken approach. And I think it's terrific. That's what I really like. But what you tend to find is that as a general rule, once the stupa gets built, then the place becomes a pilgrimage for devotion. And so lots of lay people come, buses come up from Bangkok and so on. And the forest tradition, as it's become famous, it became extremely well patronized by wealthy upper class people from Bangkok, starting with the royal family. And so once the royal family started to patronize the forest monasteries in the 1960s and 70s, they became very wealthy. And usually forest monasteries are much, much wealthier than the village monasteries in the same place. And so the katina offering that's offered each year to the forest monastery may well be 10 times or 100 times as great as the offering that's made to the local village monastery. And so, of course, with this much wealth flowing into the monasteries, then there's corruption and so on creeps in, and the monasteries become more and more luxurious, and you end up, instead of, well, the mythology speaks of the little huts and staying under mosquito nets and a bamboo hut with grass roof, and you still find those. That's where I live. When I was in Thailand, I spent free range retreat in Phu-chon-kom, staying in caves or staying in bamboo huts with grass roofs. It's not, you know, it's a reality. But in a lot of forest monasteries, you know, you're just as likely to find marble floored Dhamma hall with chandeliers and remote controlled fans and air conditioning and so on. So this is a change. This is how things develop and they evolve. And as I mentioned, that often when the main teacher dies and they build a big stupa, the place becomes a pilgrimage place. And so instead of being a place for living monks to live and practice, it becomes a place for worshipping dead monks. That's essentially what a stupa is. It's essentially what relics are. Relics are the remains of a dead monk. Stupa is a place where you put the remains of a dead monk. And so whenever that stupa worship becomes the central focus of a religion, of Buddhism, then it becomes essentially past-focused. It's not looking anymore to the living practice and the development of living practitioners to realize enlightenment. It's become a devotional practice of worshipping those in the past who have done that. And so, you know, that's not a bad thing to do. It's a good thing to do. It's a very wonderful thing to remember that. So we have a stupa here at Santi, but it's a small stupa. It's a modest one. It's something which is there, but which doesn't form the focal point of the presence in the monastery. So this is the kind of the life cycle of a forest monastery. Starts out, monks go, set up a mosquito net, build the hut, gradually put more and more buildings, make a fence around, define the land. The village expands until the farmland and eventually the houses are right up against the monastery. The main teacher dies, they build a stupa, and it becomes a pilgrimage centre, and the practice moves elsewhere. Typically, that's how it happens. So forest monasteries often don't last more than one generation. And the forest monks in Thailand are aware of this, and they do various things to try to avoid it. For example, at Ajahn Chah's monastery, they tried to set it up so that the stupa and so on would be outside of the main practice area, so that the monks could continue their practice inside without too much disturbance. At Ajahn Mahabua's monastery, he's been very resolute in not building any large or fancy buildings to try to keep that simplicity to things. So there's very much an awareness of these kinds of problems and so on within the tradition itself. But nevertheless, even though try to do what you might, then still, almost, I think it's almost inevitable that spirit of the forest tradition, it just passes out. You can't really help it. It becomes more concerned with institutional maintenance than it does with that original spirit that set it off. It becomes much more, instead of that focus on the reality of that experience in the forest, it becomes much more a devotional cult of worshipping the experience of those who've come before. So these, I think, this is the tendency in the forest tradition, the cycle, and it's something we need to be aware of. And when we set up Santi Monastery and we come to practice here at Santi, and we if we have an awareness of this dynamic and an understanding of it, then hopefully that can inform our own practice as well. And so here we try to keep a balance of a certain degree of teaching and training in terms of understanding the theory, the history of Buddhism and so on, the scriptures and the different teachings and doctrines and things. And also, you know, training, we learn how to sort of live in a monastery and do the bowing and all of these kinds of things. But we also spend a good deal of time in the wilderness by ourselves. And as time goes on and as the monastery becomes better established, we'll hopefully have more time to be able to spend just time on retreat and just, you know, spending much longer periods just by oneself. And it's in those periods when we're in retreat and just staying in the forest, this is when meditation will gradually deepen and deepen and deepen. It's very important if we want to stay in a forest monastery and we want to develop this contemplative life, it's very, very important that we develop this love of solitude, this love of seclusion, this love of meditation and quiet. And so we come in, we do our duties, do what needs to be done in the monastery. When that's finished, then we just go back. We do our meditation. If we have some study or something to do, we do that. Whatever else we've got to do, we do that. But there's this kind of nagging feeling inside us, this kind of nagging, seeking for something to do, seeking for some activity, for some distraction. And we have to be very aware of that and have to overcome that. And so we have to learn to have that feeling of when we go back in the forest alone, just to really appreciate that, just to really love that feeling, just to be there in the bush. And sometimes even being in a kuti or a room or a caravan is too much. And so it's very nice to just go and sit on a rock, sit under a tree, sit in a cave, and just spend some time there. Just watch the stars. And that's when we really begin to appreciate why the Buddha said that going to the forest was the beginning point of meditation. So this is just some reflections for you this evening on the forest tradition, the meaning of the forest tradition. And I offer this for your reflection and edification and occasional amusement. And does anyone have any comments or questions?
To me, actually making sure that the forests of the world still exists is very important.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Between going to Thailand in 1978 and going in 2006, a very appreciable lack of forests. And also all those monasteries that became huge. The monks there now, haven't got the option of heading off into the wilderness because there's not very much left.
Absolutely, yeah. Very often the monastery was originally just a place in the forest, and now the rest of the monastery is the only bit of forest left. It's the only patch outside the monastery walls. You can see, if you look at aerial photos of most of the monasteries, it's just... that's it, there's green there and outside there's nothing.
Mm.
Terrible.
I've thought about this a lot in Australia, because forest is a very rare place in Australia, the whole of the landmass. The real wilderness in Australia is the desert.
Mm.
Now, I've always thought that when there's monasteries in the desert,
mm-hmm.
in Australia will really have, Buddhism will be very deeply embedded, because that's our true wilderness.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I always think that, I don't know, I appreciate your thought on this, but I think I have thought that forest is like, it's a metaphor for the secluded place, and wherever you find seclusion is your forest in a way.
Yeah, I mean forest, the word aranya actually more literally means wilderness, rather than forest is one as such. Yeah.
It just happened that the wilderness in India was forest.
For the most part, yeah, but definitely does include desert and other kinds of wilderness areas and so on. Look, the idea of a desert monastery, I agree with you absolutely, and I've fantasized about that for over a decade, and I have some plans in the back of my mind, and so we'll wait and see what happens with that. Yeah. But it is pretty extreme. Yeah, there's a reason why there's not many people living in the middle of the Australian desert.
Yeah,
but some good underground kutis.
Yeah,
like in Kupapiti. Yep.
So with the study, quite a good message could be to, rather than criticise the study, to tell people to study the sutras and embody them, live them.
Absolutely, yeah.
This was something I noted that all of the Tibetan masters had spent years studying the sutras on the
Yeah.
And obviously one of the teachers partly to counteract, but study time.
Exactly. And that's exactly what I think that was the advice that Ajahn Mun gave to Ajahn Mahabua. He basically said, do your study, because Ajahn Mahabua completed 3 years of the curriculum in Bangkok. That's why it's called Maha. That's what Maha means. It basically means you've done a bachelor's equivalent. And Ajahn Mun said, do your study, but when you come to meditate, forget about it and just go and practice. But the study will come in useful when you need it. So everything that you've learned at that time when it's necessary, then that will come in useful. Yeah.
Maybe in Thailand or India, they were able to go to the village to get help. Whereas in somewhere like Australia, it would be a lot harder. wondering.
Yeah, very much so. You know, I mean, that's why we don't do it essentially. I think in some places you could. I think there are some, you can get alms in Australia, and there are some regions, but Australia is so sparsely populated. You know, I think if you're up, say, on the north coast around Lismore area, I think you could do Tudong. Yeah, it wouldn't be easy. They do it in England, in Ireland, so in those places, okay, but the much more bigger population in those areas. Okay, so let's finish up by paying respects to the tradition.